Entering narrative, embracing the power of story. I'm going to begin to talk a little bit differently in terms of metaphor, but we'll tie it back in. I think one of the big challenges that we have in the church, in fact, I'll start out by that, and then I'm going to actually ramp it up a little bit more. I think one of the greatest things that we're struggling with is that we are facing a profound crisis of imagination. In fact, it's my personal conviction, based on where I am, what we do around here, the opportunities that I have to engage with leaders across many traditions in many places around the country, it would be my assessment that I think it's probably the biggest issue facing the church, a crisis of imagination. And I think that for many people, the fact that it's a crisis is illustrated in this. Many of us weren't even aware that imagination had much to do with the church in the first place. And the very fact that that is a disconnect illustrates why it is such a profound crisis. Now let me give you a definition of imagination. Imagination is the faculty or action of forming new ideas, images, or concepts. Okay, I'm going to repeat that part again. That's the first half. The faculty of, or action of forming new ideas, images, or concepts of external objects not present to the senses. So the ability to see something that isn't there. The faculty or action of forming new ideas, images, or concepts of external objects not present to the senses. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds an awful lot what Jesus, sounds an awful lot like what Jesus invites the disciples to do. Wake up. Behold, the kingdom of God is at hand. I can imagine them saying, "It is?" Could have fooled me. In other words, Jesus invites the disciples to imagine and to reckon with a reality that is not immediately apparent to the senses at their disposal. He invites them to engage their imaginations. Folks, imagination is critical to leadership. It is a critical aspect to our leadership. Our ability to perceive, imagine, and create things that we believe are real, even though they might not be present to our senses. And the fact that we have such a struggle understanding and owning and internalizing that thing is a result of the crisis that we're in. It's a critical aspect of leadership. And it is my assessment that our well, our imaginative well, has run dry. That in a sense, it's become stagnant. Now, there's a lot to reckon with in terms of why it is such that we have had an imagination that has dried up in us and around us. But I would like to call attention to a couple things that I think are significant in understanding our lack of imagination in leadership and in churches as a result of that reality. I think our leadership imagination has become domesticated. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean to domesticate something? Okay, to take something wild and to make it tame. To take what is wildest of it and remove it so that it can be presentable in a house. To domesticate means to bring indoors, to make house trained. I think that's a lot of what has happened in our churches. The spirit is wild, and yet oftentimes we live in a domesticated reality as it relates to the church. And if leadership's imagination has become domesticated, then by default, our churches have been domesticated as well. And I think a lot of us are dealing with and reeling in the result of that. Now, what are some of the different things that have been responsible for domesticating our imagination? I want to suggest to you three in particular that have been quite significant. And the first is going to be way up here philosophically, okay? But I think it's really critical because it has a huge impact on the day-to-day way in which we operate. I think one of the first things that's been critical in domesticating our imagination is modern enlightenment epistemology, okay? Humongous idea. What is epistemology, anyone? How we know what we know. The way in which we conceive and perceive, the way in which truth and knowledge gets mediated. So modernity and the Enlightenment gave us a pretty profound story about how truth and knowledge are mediated. Our sensibilities around knowledge and truth were shaped primarily within the Enlightenment and within Christendom. And within this framework of the Enlightenment and modernity, truth and knowledge has some significant attributes to it. The first is that truth and knowledge is always universal. What does that mean? It means that if it's true in one place, it's true in every other place in the exact same way. So for truth, for knowledge to be universal, means that if it's true over here, that it is true in exactly the same way that it is true over here in every other place, because it's been globalized or more universalized for everybody. More than that, it's accessed through the right application of reason. It's a rational, cognitive reality. Minds apprehend reality as it is, and if it's true here, it's true in other places in the exact same way. So, that's one aspect of truth and knowledge in a modern epistemological framework. The second, it's objective. What does that mean? It means, are you all able to see that at all? Do I need to switch to black? It means that it can be held without bias. That truth and knowledge in a modern epistemological framework is objective, which means there is some privileged position whereby we shed our creatureliness to know reality as it is. Make sense? So that's the second. Universal, objective. Finally, the third most salient aspect of truth and knowledge is that it's certain. So not only is it universal, one place, every place, access to the right application of reason, objective, that is, it can be held without bias, but if it's certain, it means it can also be held without doubt. Okay? That has given us a pretty crazy approach to reality, this modern epistemological stance. Why? Because it assumes that we have the same ability to perceive reality that God himself has. And the reality is we never have a place or a position whereby we leave our situatedness in context. There's no place where we stop using culturally defined language and metaphors that allows us to access reality in the way that modern epistemological commitments force us to do. So, this is significant, this approach to truth and knowledge. Why? Because it shaped from it a corresponding culture of reductionism. Okay? What does that mean? In reductionism, what you do is you observe a complex reality in the environment and you reduce it from the many dynamic features that are conspiring together to create this complex reality. You reduce it to a simplified abstraction devoid of contextual considerations. You hear what I'm saying? When this is our approach to truth and knowledge, it creates a corresponding culture of reductionism. So we look in the environment, we see a phenomenon happen, we say, hey, there's something significant happening there. We're going to reduce it to simplified abstractions from that phenomenon that has no tie to the context that gave shape to it. That has profoundly affected our churches. Why? Because what we do often in the church today is that we find the most successful ministries out there and we reduce them to models that then leaders become experts at applying the techniques in a separate context. Why? Because by God, if it worked in South Barrington, Illinois, for Willow Creek, and if truth and knowledge is universal, then it has to work in Westport, Kansas City, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in all the same ways, right? Because if we can access and look at this dynamic situation called, just as an example, Willow Creek, and if truth and knowledge is universal, and we can be objective about it and certain about it, then we can take the phenomenon of what has happened there, reduce it to a model devoid of contextual considerations of what made it work in that place in that way. And then what happens is leadership becomes about finding, accessing the most quote-unquote successful, defined by what? Numbers, market share, ministry teams, lost people, whatever the metric that we value, we find the model, and then we become technique duplication experts. That's largely what leadership and the church has been reduced to. We are constantly looking, scanning the horizon for signs of success. Measured in the metric systems that we value, we go to those things, we invite them to tell us how they've done what they've done, all the time ignoring the unique contextual considerations that have allowed that thing to emerge in its place, the personalities, the neighborhoods, the environments, the versions of the gospel that they're engaging with, right? And it's had a huge impact on leaders and communities and imaginations. It's produced leaders dependent on experts out there. In the church, we have the cult of the expert versus leaders embedded deeply in local communities, living deeply in the narratives of their neighborhood, living deeply in the narratives of their tradition, living deeply in the narratives of the scripture, and figuring out where God in their communities is already at work and becoming responsive to the movement of the Holy Spirit in that place. Our leadership imagination has been domesticated by this modern epistemological thing, even though it's floated quite a bit down the river to get to the place where we have it. Okay? Make sense? Comments? Questions about that? Before I move on to the second? Certainly. Yeah. Kurt's comment is that you can apply it to the business world. This is the logic of the franchise, right? Something works in one place, you figure out what they've done, and then you make it replicable, and then you start dropping them with a lot of capital behind them, which is oftentimes the parachute church plant model, by the way. You just drop a team into a community with a model for church planting and just fund the heck out of them for 3 years. And then hope that the church will grow itself to the point that it can support what it's already created, you know? And so now all the pressure's on the leaders to do what? Get people there. Why? Because they've got a budget that's not normal for their size and their age. It's inflated. And so all of a sudden, right at the beginning of the church plant, it becomes what? Not about formation, not about developing an ethos, not about a culture. It's about directing and gathering numbers to support the budget. Man, you want to talk about upside down. But that's the culture that a lot of new church development is happening. So the first thing, domesticated by modern epistemological orientation. Now, the second way in which our imagination and leadership is often domesticated, this is kind of like a modern epistemology's kind of distant second cousin. A lot of us have distant second cousins. We don't talk about them a lot, right? They're kind of embarrassing the family, kind of that kind of. Well, this is like that. I think the second thing that has domesticated our imagination is ministry titillation. What do I mean by that? It's the second cousin to modern epistemology. It's not quite as refined in this deal. Ministry is a bag of tricks. Ministry is a bag of tricks. And we've had a long litany of tricks that has been titillating to leadership in the church. Let me give you an example of this. You drive down the street and you see your local church, and out front they have a banner in front of the church. Now, let's start brainstorming the litany of bags of tricks in ministry that get put on those banners one generation after another for the last 10 years in evangelical churches, just in that framework. What are some of them? Teze. Come to our Teze worship service. Alpha. VBS. Purpose-driven. Yeah, purpose-driven. It's great for 40 days, but what do you do with your people on day 41, right? That's it. What else? There's a whole lot of them. Willow Creek, right? That's a ministry bag of tricks. Small group movement. That one has just been with us for a long time is all. Contemporary worship movement. Come to our contemporary service, which basically means bad Maranatha music from the 80s. Contemporary doesn't mean right now. That means what was happening in the late 80s. With Maranatha and those. So in other words, it's this culture of movement that is not about engaging. Let me give you an example. And by the way, back to our metaphor of being lost and the need to remap, I think these things are a function of being disoriented, of being in an environment where nothing around us matches our mental maps of what reality is. And so if adrenaline is the drug driving us forward, then these little bags of tricks are our grasping at trying to figure out how we get ourselves remapped. And just like in the wilderness, panic escalates, and we get more frenetic, and each thing we realize works a little less long than the one before it. That's kind of what's happened in church leadership as well. What's the next thing? Well, guess what the next thing is? Emerging church. Emerging church is the next in a long litany of tricks that the modern imagination, in its poverty, has seized onto in order to try and reorient itself so that it can become, fill in the blank, relevant, effective, successful. Make sense? You guys tracking with me on this? Okay, let me give you an example of this. By the way, here's a great quote. It is not revolutions and upheavals that clear the road to new and better days, but revelations, lavishness, and torments of someone's soul inspired and ablaze. Sorry, I just had to throw that in. It's a really good picture. Okay, say again? Well, I want to go to another quote. I'll come back to it at the end. About a year and a half ago, Jacob's Well was profiled in Christian Century magazine by an editor there named Jason Biasi. They were profiling an emerging church for the second time in the history of the issue, and they'd made the decision to use Jacob's Well as a reference for the larger emerging church movement. And so Jason was here a couple Junes ago, and then it ran in October. And if you read the Christian Century, one of the things you know about that magazine is that the last page has a column every month by Martin Marty. And then at the bottom, it says, in next month's issues, and then it says, here's what's coming, right? So on that month's previous month's issue, it said, Jason Biasi on the emerging church. Okay, so Jason got an email from a classmate friend of his who saw that he would soon be hearing about the emerging church from Jason. And this is the email that was sent to him by his buddy. I was just reading the latest edition of the Christian Century and noticed at the bottom that you have an article on the emergent church coming soon. I really look forward to that. Last week, I attended a conference on worship our denomination put on. We heard the word emergent countless times, but after several hours of workshops and plenary discussions, a classmate leaned over to me and said, I still don't know what emergent worship is. But now, I am convinced that neither do these presenters. That's funny, I think. It's true. He goes on to say, I have heard these supposed experts, and still have the looming question, what in God's name is emerging worship? My hunch is that it's not in God's name so much as it is in the name of meeting people's perceived needs, fueling our addiction to visual technologies and our ADHD culture, mixing in a few ancient practices, a little incense burning here, a little chanting there, to make it seem edgy and new, because the old edgy and new has ceased to be edgy and new these days. It was a total waste. Part of me wants to be wrong about emergent worship. here's hoping that you can convince me I am wrong. Hear what I'm saying? It's a long line in a litany of tricks that people are grabbing onto in an attempt to get control, to reorient, to figure out how do we get a hold of this missing demographic, whatever that may be in our church. Okay? Now, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to contrast that email with an amazing piece of writing that comes from Thomas Merton in his book, The Sign of Jonas, which is the collection of journals that he has written after he gets into Gethsemane. The seven-story mountain gets him to Gethsemane, and then after that, Sign of Jonas is the first collection of journals. And he's talking in this instance about architecture, but as you listen to what Merton writes, think about it and contrast it to what the email that Jason Biasi got from this guy who went to this worship school about emergent worship. The perfection of the 12th century Cistercian architecture is not to be explained by saying that the Cistercians were looking for a new technique. I am not sure they were looking for a new technique at all. They built good churches because they were, read with me, looking for God. And they were looking for God in a way that was pure and integral enough to make everything they did and everything they touched give glory to God. We cannot reproduce what they did because we approach the problem in a way that makes it impossible for us to find a solution. We ask ourselves a question that they never considered. How shall we build a beautiful monastery according to the style of some past age and according to the rules of a dead tradition? Thus we make the problem not only infinitely complicated, but we make it, in fact, unsolvable. Because why? A dead style is what? A dead style. And he continues. The reason that it is dead is that the motives that once gave it life have ceased to exist. They have given place to a situation that demands another style. If we were intent upon loving God rather than upon getting a Gothic church out of a small budget, we would soon put up something that would give glory to God and would be very simple and would also be in the tradition of our fathers. It's amazing. Let's take a few minutes and compare and contrast the dynamic of what we read in the email to Jason in the Christian century and what Merton here is describing, okay? Give me some characteristics for the Christian century email. What's going on there? What's the motivation? What's driving what's happening in that curve? Okay, it's focused on an experience, and I would add to that, driven towards an outcome. The outcome being relevance. Okay, what else? Christian century email. Deconstruct it a little bit. What's going on there? Yeah, Jason. Say it again. Okay. Okay, there's no imagination whatsoever, and it's seeking to apply something alien. Okay, anything else? What's being sought? I mean, what's the goal here in this email? Yeah, Ben. Hipness? Yeah. So it's a pursuit of something that feels transitory, maybe? Just something that's hip or whatever? Yeah. The guy who wrote it, you know, was trying to figure out if there's any substance. Okay. So it's vacuous, would be a different, on the other side of saying it. There's just no there. No one knows it about, including the people who are talking about it. The thing that's really hilarious is I edited that email. I took stuff out, and one of the things they did is they were doing a parable of Lazarus and, you know, not giving the poor man a cup of water, or the parable in Lazarus asking for a cup of water. And the way that they had people internalize that was they gave them a red fire-hot jawbreaker to hold in their mouth as an experience of what it must have been like to be. Cutting edge. Ashley, what were you going to say? Okay, so the assumption is that the people in our community are consumers, and we're trying to find the new product that will reach them and make what we have to sell hot in that particular demographic. Okay, anybody else want to say anything about the Christian Century email? No? Okay, let's talk about Thomas Merton and his description of the 12th century Cistercian community and the architecture that they produced. What things stand out from that particular framing? Okay, so whereas this thing seems focused on everything but God, the Cistercians were focused, at least according to Merton, primarily on God. And what would you say the architecture was? It was a byproduct of that primary pursuit. Their imagination flowed out of what I would say, what Merton is saying, is a deep engagement with themselves, with their community, and with their environment. So that when they create something, it has, here's what I would like to use, integrity. It matches the reality of who they are versus this poor guy that spent all kinds of money to get to this worship school and sits there and just gets angrier and angrier and angrier. And rightly so. Why? Because it's an absolute waste. There's no integrity to what he's experiencing. And he's looking to his leadership to provide for him a means of learning how to engage, and he's getting just the opposite. His assessment is, this does not help me. This takes me further from God. Good. Any other comments about the distinction or difference between what's going on here in this email and what Thomas Merton is describing? Ivy, go ahead. Yeah. Diversity is actually celebrated as opposed to uniformity being the norm. Creativity, imagination has a stamp of particularity to it that's unique. And what does it do? It gives profound dignity to the community that allows something to come out of it and its integral approach to itself versus assuming somebody else out there has figured it out and the rest of us, we're idiots. God only speaks to a certain segment of the population. Everybody else is just on board to duplicate. It's a ministry of Xerox. Right? Any other comments on this? Yeah, go ahead, Sean. Yeah, Merton's email is filled with hope. In what sense do you think, why? Where did you discern that, or what do you think is going on that creates in Merton this sense of hope? There's authenticity there. That being in relationship with God is generative. Creativity flows to our intimate connection to God. And it comes communally, not just individually. Whereas the email feels like it's filled with some despair and a ratcheting up of cynicism. Which, I don't know, is it the opposite of hope? Is cynicism the opposite of hope? It might be. One's going through the motions, one's engaging. Yeah. Now, here's the other challenge about this. We live in a culture that is all about duplication. It's all about franchise. And the minute something original happens, it's immediately whoosh, and deprived of its wildness. It's domesticated. and turned into something different. See, do you see in this instance the challenge to leadership we face? The challenge to leadership we face and how such things domesticate, I would even go even further, neuter imagination. The breeding metaphor is intentional. When you domesticate something, well, I'm going to save that for a few minutes. Back in there, you had in the back row a comment you wanted to make. Your name is?
Tom.
Tom, go ahead. Welcome. Yes. To pick up this banner? Yeah. I guess my only thing would be to say, you can judge a tree by its fruit. And I think the result is, if you actually talk to leaders, to follow Jesus is not an easy yoke with a light burden. It's a desperate grab at these people who themselves profit significantly by the turning over of these things. I mean, this is aided and abetted by a publishing industry that is not out of the woods in terms of its commitment to these things financially. Yeah. Yeah. For some, it can be. I have not seen a lot of evidence of that being a positive, because it's them trying to desperately grab onto something that's not honestly quite true about who they are or what they are, so they end up trying to put on somebody else's costume,
right.
And that just ends up looking embarrassing.
Right, but maybe after that embarrassment, they go, you know, we can maybe try this ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it can be in many contexts. And yet at the same time, one of the contentions I will make is that my conviction is that God's Spirit is always already ahead of us, active in the communities that we're a part of. And that part of this dependence and addiction to this orientation is keeping us from being aware of what God is already active in doing in our communities. And so leadership becomes about co-opting other people's stuff and then trying to fawn it off on our people to get them in line to do those things, versus creating environments and asking questions that allow for God's work in us that's already going on to actually rise to the surface. And then we join what God's doing, as opposed to assuming. We'll get there, yes. Technology has allowed for the massive reproduction and distribution of information. How that's used, in our community, technology is a huge part, and it's not a trick. It's a function of the fact that we are a very tech-savvy community, and so it's just part of the literacy, but we're also a very incarnated community. We're flesh, we're incarnate. And we're also virtual. We live in both places because most of our people live in both those places. So for us, it's just faithful. Other communities that latch onto that, hey, we got to get this killer website so that we can be relevant to this. I mean, it just depends on how are you engaging it in that sense. One more, yes. Yeah. Well, it's a good question. What's the fine line between learning from somebody, or maybe I would use a spiritual word here, to be inspired, versus thinking I'm going to be arrogant, I'm going to reinvent the wheel? Some people are called to reinvent the wheel. Some people are called to do that. But creativity, it never in my life has happened in a vacuum. But what happens is I get in communities with people, and where the culture is there, we inspire one another. And so the question is, when I come away from our time together, do I feel like I have to go do what you've done? Or did my time with you cause me and give me the opportunity and the ability to also think with my community what it might look like for us to respond similarly in our environment, as opposed to how do we just go do what they did? You know what I mean? So there are some things we borrow. I mean, but it is a fine line, and that's why this is an art. It's a relationship. I want to keep moving a little bit on this, because the third thing that I would say that has been significant in terms of domesticating our imagination after the modern epistemology and ministry titillation is the isolation that most of us experience in churches. And this is Protestantism's dirty little secret. That Protestantism has within it a logic to it that makes unity an impossibility. The logic of the Reformation is that every time we disagree with one another, we have to break relationship. Because the greatest sin in the Western church is heresy, not holding right doctrine. But in the Eastern church, it's schism, breaking fellowship. In the West, we have a logic that says every time we disagree with one another, we have to break fellowship. Because the worst thing you can do is hold a wrong doctrinal position. We see the aftermath, the carnage of that all over our churches, do we not? Truly, we do. There's a logic of Protestantism that says disagree, break relationship. As a result, we've become splintered, balkanized, and that has produced isolation. Now, back on this metaphor of a domestication, one of the things that we know biologically is that for a species to thrive, the gene pool has to have enormous diversity. When a gene pool in a species gets isolated, what happens? Huh? Mutation. It gets weak. It begins to produce mutation, deform. And ultimately, species lose the ability to create offspring. Does that sound like any of our churches? We've gotten so isolated and inbred that most of what a lot of churches are producing are not communities that continue to thrive, but rather that continue to shrink, become more like itself, continue to divide, and cannot reproduce anybody. There's nobody new coming in. And so that has been the creation of a deformed and sterile church. That's why I think a lot of us are talking about things like being post-Protestant, post-Reformation. We're just not protesting anymore. It had its place, but we are post-Protestant. So let me give an example of this. When we have this conversation, I'm going to skip through some quotes here. Oftentimes in emerging circles, people want to say, emerging churches, how big is the emerging church, quote unquote? Their idea is up here, maybe this is Roman Catholic, over here at Southern Baptist, ELCA, Episcopal, you know, each one of these denominations, right, is what? A slice of the pie? The assumption being that what slice of the pie is emergent now, right? Because the only logic that we have for these kinds of realities is to divide. And now emergent is now the newest line in the division. But there's a better metaphor than this, than a pie that's sliced. There is a pie that does get sliced in these different ways. But if we look to biology again, think about how a tree grows. When a tree grows, how does it grow? How can you tell how old a tree is? It adds a ring. So when you cut it, when you do a cross-section of a tree, you begin to see this thing going on. And you count the rings to discover how big, how old is this tree. And so many people who are talking about this phenomenon, and not just in religion, but across the deal, is rather than seeing emergent as a narrower slice of the pie, we're asking the question, what if this thing is the next ring of growth in the church, so that, for example, there are Roman Catholics who are way down here in terms of their tradition. And there are other Roman Catholics that are out here in the emergent edge of what's going on. Same thing in the Southern Baptist and in the Lutherans and in the Methodist and in Episcopal context, in charismatic churches. People are actually beginning to use post-charismatic language, if you can believe that. So that what we're discovering is that people out here, Southern Baptist, God forbid, actually have more in common with Roman Catholics than some of those people do within their own traditions. And within this framework, there's starting to be an enormous amount of cross-pollinization. People are beginning to talk across traditions, discovering things about engaging God and engaging spiritual practices, engaging narratives that are fertilizing their imaginations and causing them to think in different ways about how they've understood and engaged with God in that framework. So here's a great picture of a cross-section of a tree. Now, the thing that is interesting about this picture is in this picture, there are points in the tree's history where things that are very close to each other are divided. But how does the tree deal with that? It eventually grows around them. Rather than these lines, these division things being once for all, we say there was a time when we had to divide. In 1 Corinthians 11, I think Paul says, sometimes it's necessary that there are differences among you so who is true can be proved. There are times when there's error that needs to be weeded out, right? But historically, do we just continue to stay broken apart from one another? Or is there something that needs to happen that would allow our imaginations to engage God, recognizing that diversity is actually a creative force for good and for the building of the kingdom? See, one of the things that's been really unique about being at Jacob's Well is though my tradition is quite muddled in terms of my past. I started in a Methodist church, came of age in a Southern Baptist church, went to an Episcopal youth group, was a part of three different parachurch youth ministries, became a follower of Jesus in a Presbyterian church, was in a campus ministry that wasn't attached to any of those things, was involved in Young Life on staff. My dad's an Episcopal priest now as a second career. My kids go to Catholic school. I'm a mutt, right? It's made the community of Jacob's Well, this whole orientation towards openness, be a place as a non-denominational church that has the ability to host some diversity. It doesn't mean that everybody should be like that, but the thing that's extraordinary is as a result, a lot of times what we'll see, especially because we have a Sunday night service, that different people from different traditions come to either worship here because they're so exhausted after serving that they can't be fed at church, so they come at night to get fed themselves and to worship and to relax, but also to see what's going on. And the amazing thing, and I'm not making any kind of doctrinal judgment here, but I mean, I remember one time looking out and seeing a Southern Baptist pastor sitting next to a Unitarian Universalist pastor, and they were both nodding at the same thing I was saying. You see what I'm saying? In other words, I think this logic of division has been devastating to us. It's isolated us. It creates a pretty grim picture of the church. And yet, I think one of the things I'm experiencing, one of the things people around here are experiencing, and one of the things that I'm engaging with leaders on, is that there's at the same time a profound level of hope. This is where we've been, but we're trying to deconstruct it so that we might find and move to a new place, that we can reorient, that we can remap. We're listening to new sources and voices and stories, and something is new is being birthed in us and through us. And I think what we're discovering is that the postmodern, the emerging, the missional church, whatever you want to call it, is a reclamation, it's a rediscovery, it's a recovery of the particular and the local, above and beyond anything else. It's a reclaiming of the particular and the local, of specificity, of story, of narrative, and of context. It's doing what we talked about at the end of the last session. It's finding ourselves. Amidst all the temptation to do something different, who are we? What is our story? Where do we live? And what does it look like for us to engage God in this place? I'm going to invite a couple comments or questions, and then I'm going to move us into the next little part of this, and then we'll cruise and go to our groups. But any comments or questions about this idea of domesticated imagination and the possible different reasons why we've gotten ourselves into this place? Comments, observations? Can I get a witness? Anybody feel that dynamic that I'm describing? Brian, go ahead. Okay, well, let me speak for the behalf of you who can't hear him. He says to reorient, to engage imagination is a place of profound vulnerability. When you're trying to reorient, remap, you can't hide anywhere. You can't, go ahead. The idea of a leader is that you're ahead of people. And so it's hard to stay ahead of people. Now, my question would be, as a leader, are we supposed to stay ahead of people? Or are people supposed to lead us somewhere? I would say my experience is it's the second, depending on what you think leadership is. Good. Good. What else? Any other comments as it relates to this idea of domesticated imagination? The things, yeah, go ahead. So imagination equaled delusion somehow? Yeah. Yeah. Any other comments? Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Where does imagination and doubt
interplay? Do you have any thoughts about that? Well, I think the idea of imagination is, if we use our initial, the faculty or action of perceiving or engaging possible things that are invisible to the external senses, I think we have to constantly be in the process of saying, is this thing I'm imagining, is it have any basis in a possibility? So there are things that we can imagine that may not be, the spirit may not be there. And so I think the idea of having a healthy community that measures and tests these things is an important faculty as it relates to that, but I'm not sure if that gets at what you're asking. An absolute, yeah. Right, that's right. Well, that's a good point. Right. If they can engage doubt, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Okay, good. Good. I think so too. And it's been MIA, yes. Just a little bit louder. It's easier not to have imagination. And yet, how high is the cost? So it's easier in the short term, right? Until we're in the middle of the wilderness with no reference around us that we can recognize, right? And then all of a sudden we're like, oh, I wish I would have started this process a little earlier. So it's easy on the front end, very dangerous on the long term. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, that's exactly right. Imagination is so much more easier in the context of a community. For me, one of the things that was formative is I was an art student at the University of Kansas, the concept of a studio. You create something, and then the teacher calls time out, and everybody goes and puts their work on the wall, and then people say, I think you're full of it. I don't think that says at all what you think it says. In other words, you do this thing called critique. So it's not as if imagination exists in this la-la land where no one ever gives any hard data about what you're doing. The idea is that communities create together in a responsive way that is really good. Just a couple more, yes.
Well, with all the new ways we have of telling stories,
yes,
it almost seems like the church lost the ability to tell its own story.
Hmm.
It just has been trying to adopt other stories.
Okay. We've lost the ability to tell stories. I mean, honestly, and this may not be true of this group, there aren't very many Christians who read fiction. We just don't know how good stories even work. We don't even read fiction as if becoming a good storyteller might be important to things like preaching. Because if this approach to truth is the way it is, then the Bible becomes this source book that we mine for universal, objective, and certain principles that we then just give people as if faith is fact. Versus inviting people into the narrative of God and his people wrestling with each other through time in very confusing environments, constantly in the process of remapping, like we saw in 1 Samuel chapter 4. I want to take a little bit of time to now get out of some of the theoretical things and just do some storytelling. I'd like to actually, for those of you who don't know it, take a few minutes to talk about the story of Jacob's well. For me, it's a very personal story. I grew up in the church, like you've heard me describe, but for me, a crisis came when I was a senior in high school and my parents got divorced. All of a sudden, my world got shattered. I had just started dating this gal who's now my wife, but she had become a Christian. I had been in a Christian church. I had walked away from that stuff. I was completely self-destructive. And yet, at a time of complete disillusion of my life, my reality, my family, my relationship to her connected me to a group of Christians who then became, for me, my new family. At a time when I was most exposed, most vulnerable, most self-destructive, God rescued me through a body of believers called the local church. In some of these emergent conversations, some people are really hostile to the church. I have no place for that in my life. The church saved my life. I have no experience of God that has not been mediated by his people. The bride of Christ is amazing, and I have given my life to serving her because of the impact she had on me and continues to have on me, informing and shaping me. I am given over body, mind, soul, spirit to serving God by being connected to his people. I don't have any understanding of God apart from his people. That's been my story. It's a love affair that I am quite happy to continue, and my wife seems to tolerate with a great deal of patience. Immediately what happened for me when I became a Christian as a senior in high school, I went away to college, and I got involved in this campus ministry that was quite extraordinary. There were no staff people there. It was a group of college people living their lives together, sharing life, doing things together, and as we were spending our time together, the community began to explode. It began to develop, not because we were trying to be relevant, not because we were trying to reach anybody, but because we were sharing our lives together. The Bible talked about praying, so it seems like maybe a couple mornings a week we'd get up early and meet at chapel and pray. The Bible talked about serving the poor, so we would regularly, pretty consistently go down to the Salvation Army shelter and engage there. Our lives just had this natural overflow. But what was extraordinary about that time in my life was that I became a part of a community of people that were living their life and their faith as a way of life. It was completely experience-altering. It was completely life-orienting. And then one of the worst possible things in the world happened to me that could have happened to me. I graduated. By that time, I had a pretty significant sense of call in my life, so I went to work as a youth pastor, Young Life Church partner, at a suburban church, and over the next 3.5 years, I began to systematically lose my faith. Now, what do I mean by that? I do not mean that I lost the content of my doctrine. What I mean is that for 3.5 years, 4.5 years, Christianity for me had been a way of life. It had been a community of people sharing life together in a profound way. And when I left that community and went into this, and this is no knock on suburban context, but it was a suburban mega seeker thing. The first thing I did when I was a staff person was got in a van, drove to Barrington, Illinois in 1991, sit in on the Willow Creek Church Leadership Conference. First thing I did. The next thing that happened is we came back and had our first church fight about switching the church to a Willow Creek seeker model. So I witnessed that whole thing happen. Over that 3.5 years, I lost my faith. I lost my way of life in community. I felt like I was constantly preparing for a game that I never played in. It was largely about program. And this is a good and creative and lovely group of people, but within a paradigm that was largely everything that we've described here tonight, here and on this half of the continuum, right? And so after 3.5 years, I was done. And so I did what many people do at that stage in their life when they're really struggling to know what God asks of them and are confused by their circumstances. I went to seminary. And not only did it not help, it got worse. Because the world that the seminary I was going at to was engaging was not the world that I had lived my life in. And as a result of that, now I'm 7 years away from this primal experience of Christian community. And functionally, my faith is hanging on by a thread. And I had this moment of profound crisis, existentially, that I think a lot of us at different times in our life have. And if you haven't, hold on, it's coming. But I was getting close to the end of my experience. I was about to graduate from seminary. I had no idea what in the world was next. I was scared to death. Had two kids by this point. I was $20,000 in seminary debt. And as seminary was winding down, I was more often taking the opportunity to go up into the mountains to hike and really to yell at God, to be honest. But I had this moment in the mountains where in that place of crisis, I said to God, I cannot believe that you intended the best years of my life as a Christian to be spent between the ages of 19 and 21. And that I'm going to spend the rest of my life going through the motions. I cannot accept that. So either, God, you're alive and active in the world, just in none of the places I'm looking, or you're not, and I'm just going to go make money. Does that resonate with anybody, that dynamic? Because I kept going into churches, not trying to be hip, not trying to be relevant, not trying to reach people, folks. I just was desperate for God. I wanted to go into a church and have a sense that somewhere in this place, God was alive and active and engaging the people that I was around. And this was not meant to be arrogant. It was not meant to be judgmental. It just felt to me like every time I walked into a church, people were going through the motions. Nobody expected God to show up at any level. Really. Most churches were trying to reach some person out there and using most of their congregation in an attempt to reach those missing people. And so for me, Jacob's Well, the starting of this church, was literally began as an experiment. The idea being, I do believe that God is active and alive in the world. Just in none of the places I've been looking. So I'm going to go on a search for life. Signs of life. And I'm not going to determine in advance where I'm going to see those things. And I'm going to do it with people who I'm going to share life together with. We're going to go searching for signs of God's life. And when we experience them, we're going to grab onto them. Not tightly, but we're going to lean into what those things are. Because we started Jacob's Well, or I should say at least I started Jacob's Well, not as an attempt to reach somebody else. I was trying to create a church or start a church for me. I don't know how that strikes you, but I needed a place where I could meet with God. I'm just desperately hungry for God in my life. I needed an experience of what Merton was describing. And I think that for me became a real place of revelation. Jacob's Well was an experiment with the belief that the Spirit of God was alive and active in the world and that God wanted us to do radical engagement versus going through the motions. How do we engage as a community? Do we have a there? Do you know what I mean by that? When people come into your communities, is there a there? Is there something to invite them into, to be a part of? Is your community living your faith as a way of life that is to be something that people can invite themselves into? One of the things that I learned in this process is that one of the most challenging things is that we have an incredibly acceptable form of idolatry in the church today. The most acceptable form of idolatry in the American church is ministry. We worship ministry versus what Jesus describes. Ministry versus the organic growth coming out of deep abiding with God. Jesus has this interesting thing to say in John chapter 15. I am the vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me as I also remain in me. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. And then the crux right here. I am the vine. You are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. According to Jesus, ministry is never an end to be pursued. Like Merton described, God is our pursuit. Ministry, beautiful architecture, creativity, it's the byproduct of a primal pursuit of God. The question as leaders that we've got to be asking is, what does it mean for us to abide? Individually and as a community. What are the practices and the forms that allow a community to do deep engagement with God, trusting that ministry is a byproduct, the overflow? Here's how most of us pursue ministry. If we're trees, this is what it looks like for us, most of us. Or I don't mean this group, I mean broadly. Trying to squeeze out fruit, right? Just effort. It's just in the hopes that this, or often what we do is we walk around to other trees that are fruitful, pick up fruit off the ground, and then tape them to our branches. Folks, according to Jesus, fruit is the byproduct of a tree living in radical connection to its environment, so that fruit is the result, the byproduct of that intimate connection of organism to environment. That trees don't make fruit happen, and they can't stop it from happening. In the same way, ministry is not something we generate, nor is it something that we can stop from happening through us. You know, the dirty little secret of Jacob's well is that people think we've been particularly effective of reaching a demographic that most churches are missing, the 18 to 30 demographic. Our church is filled with the demographic that most churches are missing. Guess what? We don't care. That is the sign of something else. We're not trying to figure out how to reach or target young people in our community. We never talk about it. We never think about it. We're being ourselves. We're trying to figure out what it looks like for us to engage God and abide in our environment. And there's byproduct that's coming as a result of some of those things. So what does it mean for us to abide personally and corporately? And how does abiding generate community? Just a couple more thoughts. I think oftentimes we think in terms of birthing or developing a ministry. Let me propose something different. Giving shape to, creating environments that birth organic communities that develop a way of life in a contextually responsive and biblically faithful way. What does it look like for you and your environment to deeply engage, to share life with a community of people with the goal of abiding in Christ, such that a contextually generated response comes out of you and that community abiding together in God, trusting God for the results or the lack of results? The issue is faithfulness, not success. This is what I believe births mission. We actually create a way of life that is contextually generated and historically faithful. Mission flows out of those things. Just a couple quotes to conclude. And here's a compelling picture, I think. We think of trees as what happens where we can see it. But the reality is, it's what happens where it's unseen that creates the possibility of what appears on the surface. What is unseen in our lives? Do our communities have a depth, a reality, apart from the surface of what everybody else sees? A different piece of art. This was created from a guy in our community. I love that. This is my prayer as a leader at Jacob's Well, that this would be reflective of the reality of our church. That there would be this massively hidden depth to who we are. Most churches, most people are a mile wide and an inch deep. I want to be an inch wide and a mile deep. Okay, a couple quotes to conclude with. Leslie Newbegin, missionary to India for 35 years, comes back to Great Britain, realizes that the gospel has been domesticated in the West, asks the question, what does it look like to reconvert the West in light of the hold the Enlightenment and modernity has had on the West? This is Newbegin's answer. How can this strange story of God made man, of a crucified Savior, of resurrection and new creation become credible for those whose entire mental training has conditioned them to believe that the real world is the world that can be satisfactorily explained and managed without the hypothesis of God? How does the gospel become real to a group of people whose entire narrative of reality mitigates against the story of the gospel? Hear it? Hear the question? Here's the answer. I know of only one clue to the answering of that question, only one real hermeneutic of the gospel: congregations that believe it. Do you know how radical that is? It seems so small. He's not saying believe in the way that modern epistemology has said believe. He's saying believe in the way that Jesus invites the disciples to believe as it relates to imagination. Behold, the kingdom of God is at hand. There is an alternate reality available to each of us in our communities. Do we believe that? Are we living in response to the hidden reality of the kingdom of God and ordering our entire life around this hidden reality and allowing that to shape our perspective? Because that is ultimately the only hermeneutic available to people who live in the world that we live in, a congregation who orders their life and lives Christianity as a way of life, totally and completely in response to the other narratives that the world offers. Stanley Hauerwas agrees, the work of Jesus was not a new set of ideals or principles for reforming or even revolutionizing society, but the establishment of a new community, a people that embodied forgiveness, sharing in self-sacrificing love and its rituals and disciplines. In that sense, the visible church is not to be the bearer of Christ's message. We are to what? Be the message. As leaders, are we creating, are we developing communities that invite people into an alternate reality, to live their lives in a different narrative than the one the world has given us? That's where the gospel begins to really have some enormous power. Comments, questions, observations. It's 8:30, we're getting tired. Feedback. Yes. Say, this is a gift. Say more.
We have a tendency to commodify worship as a style. Hmm. Constituent to a democracy, a certain demographic, rather than worship as a gift, a response to a gift that's been given.
Okay, worship as a gift. Good. Good. Other comments, thoughts? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, here's what I would say is that imagination is a casualty of this reality, among other things that I've described. The diversity, I mean, the lack of unity, the diversity, that we've had environments that have been hospitable to certain kinds of things and hostile to others. We're missing imagination. So I think leadership often is about the creation of environments. And do we create environments that allow for certain things to be present in the midst? Not by because we're saying, hey, how can we be more imaginative? But how do we create environments where imagination is a part of a valued currency? Does that make sense? as opposed to saying, hey, now all we've got to do is become more imaginative, so we're going to do all these creative think tanks all of a sudden. It's more of a currency that we learn to develop and have as part of an ethos as a community. Does that make sense? I appreciate the ability to clarify that. Yeah. Yes.
Of the model to grab onto and duplicate it because the world is so busy.
It's quick.
So how do you create space and time? Because that creativity takes time.
It's common is that creativity and imagination take time, and I would say radical engagement. And one of the lures of these kind of things is that they're immediate. They produce certain kinds of results on almost a guaranteed level, and so there creates to it a bit of a logic thing, yeah. Okay, so there's a dynamic that's somewhat toxic towards leadership and this kind of a leadership in the church that we're so results-oriented that the idea would say, let's do some radical environmental engagement for the next, not 2 months, the next 2 years in order to really have a sense of who we are, what's going on in our lives, the narratives that God is giving us as a community, what's going on. How do we do that when the currency is... results, yeah.
Which just goes back to that your first talk about the adrenaline, right? I
mean, yep. It ties back into the adrenalized orientation that we have when we're disoriented and needing to remap. The hippocampal cells are shut down. We're not remapping. The adrenaline is flooding with the amygdala, so we're jamming at things. Yes. This is good news. Yeah. Amen. Praise God. David.
Well, it's interesting that you just said that because I'm having the exact opposite experience, which is a total loss of control.
Hmm.
You know, that as you're talking about this, that there seems to be, the ideas of a universal objective and something that's certain, that I can control everything. And then if that's not how it is, I've lost that sense of control. I have to go to a place of imagination. I've lost control.
Yeah. So it's orienting for some and disorienting for others. Yeah, Charlie. Yes. You get right. Yeah. It is. The idea that leaders, the previous paradigm is leaders who are the vision bearers. They go away, they discover the thing. Now, here's what's interesting. I mean, let's be honest. Part of Jacob's Well's founding is that I had this experience of crisis, right? Let's be honest. I mean, it started in a person, in a place. But here's what happened. I started telling this story in confusion to people, not saying, here's where we're going, here's where I'm confused, and people begin to say, no kidding, me too. And so rather than becoming a place where I'm rallying people to a vision, it was creating a space of dialogue and storytelling to discover something. And here's the other thing that I left out of this whole deal. The other part of this is a radical individualization of knowledge, which then gets very quickly co-opted into American consumerism, right? That churches are largely filled with collections of individuals who gather together based on shared personal preferences. I like this preaching, I like this worship style, I like these programs, and as long as we continue to provide for people those goods and services, then they give us their money. We call them tithes, but it's payment for services rendered. Because in that paradigm, the metaphor is church as mall. You go to one place to get all your goods and services. It might be different franchises within that mall, different ministry teams, different programs, different age groups, all segregated from one another. Versus, here's the biblical reality, And again, my own personal theology coming out here, I don't think God sees us individually. I think we're personal. I think individuality is a Western myth. We're socially constructed creatures. The Trinity is a socially constructed reality. Why would it be different for us? We live in relationship to one another. I believe God sees us first as a people, and secondarily, personally. So one of the things that we're discovering at Jacob's Well is that God has a story that's common for our community. So when we start asking people what's going on in your life, when we start listening for signs of life in our stories together, we find patterns. In other words, God's doing something across our community. So when we preach, there's a pulse that is actually getting hit. When our songwriters write songs, they actually reflect the ethos and pathos of our people, because we're not just a collection of individuals. God is perceiving us collectively. And as a result, and that's the other thing, that's the good news about this thing. The thing that makes creativity and imagination so exciting, David, is that we don't have to do it by ourselves. It's generative of community and gets generated in community. So to become vulnerable is to invite relationship. So the thing that makes community scary, the thing that makes creative scary, vulnerability, is the very thing that creates the possibility of being known and creating community and allowing something to emerge out of that. Ashley, were you going to say something? No. Okay. Yes.
Your experience comes out of a church plan, a church start.
Yes.
How do the dynamics change? How does the approach change in an institutional church, mainline denomination?
I think a lot of people are at this point, I mean, a lot of things that have happened in emerging churches is because they've been kind of apostolic, kind of new things. But what's happening is now it's been a decade, and so there has been diffusion of innovation that has been going on. And so there's a lot of people in mainline situations that are asking these questions. It's not my context, so I don't necessarily have the ability to say how that gets diffused, how it gets incorporated. But here's what I can tell you. God is at work in your community. Believe it with all my heart. So the question is, what does it look like for you? I don't care if you have a building like this, if you do music like we do, if you light candles. I mean, that's us being us. To me, emergent is about a posture of engagement. How do you live radically in the context of what you're doing? Because my experience has been, there are people in your congregations that are experiencing God's life. And what the most leaders do is they skip past the movement of God in their community to find movement somewhere else and then try to get people to abandon what God's already doing in their life to do what they think that they ought to do. So the question in your community is, how do you begin to create spaces that gives people permission to tell their stories and to discover what God is actively doing in your community? This is the great gift of Alan Roxburgh theologically. He says, God's future lies among God's people. That the missional imagination of the church comes out of her people, not out of really savvy leaders. So as leaders, we have to reorient our imaginations and our metaphors. Instead of leader as expert, we have to start thinking about leaders as environmentalists. Environmentalists create environments where the possibility of life can come out. So that's just a totally different posture. It's not an answer to your question, but does that help begin? Because I think the assumption is there's nothing going on here. Can anything good happen out of Nazareth? Right? Apparently so. Good. Any kind of concluding comments?